Greetings and welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church on Kirkpatrick Road in Burlington, North Carolina. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. If you'd like to correspond with Pastor Barkman and the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. The Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. Now with today's message from God's Word, here is Pastor Greg Barkman.
Well, we have been working our way through Paul's address on Mars Hill, found in Acts chapter 17, and learning from it, I trust, how Paul addressed people who did not have a Bible background. When he was evangelizing among Jews, he had one approach, not an identical approach, but a pretty standard approach. As you study his various addresses in synagogues, you'll find a very close similarity to all of them. And then among Gentiles, those who did not have the background of the Old Testament scriptures, Paul had a very different approach. And though we do not have as many examples of that approach in the Bible, we do have some, and this is probably the most notable. And it is therefore very helpful to Christians in wrestling with how do I talk to my unsaved neighbors who don't know much about Christianity. A growing percentage of the population certainly has grown a lot since I was a young man. We are becoming increasingly pagan, increasingly removed from our Christian heritage and foundation in American society today. And so we remember that Paul opened with a very skillful entry into their hearts and minds by commending them on being so religious because they had altars to every conceivably known God and even one to the unknown God, just in case they had left one out. And Paul said, that's the one I'm going to tell you about. The one that you don't know about, you know about all these others. Of course, what they knew was myth, as we know, and probably many of them suspected as well. But the one that you don't know about, he's the one I'm going to tell you about. You need to know about him, and of course it turns out that he is the greatest God of all. In fact, he is the only true and living God. But Paul begins with that skillful introduction and then begins to lay a foundation for the gospel. And really, in many ways, that's all this is a foundation for the gospel. It's not really an explicit gospel message. It is the foundational understanding that people must have before they are able to understand and receive the gospel message. So Paul didn't begin by saying, smile, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life. But he started with the knowledge of God as creator and ruler and other facets of his nature and character, which they needed to understand. And he was basically painting the accurate picture of a big God and small people. The human mind conceives of man as being big and God as being just a little bit bigger. And that's the way all the pagan gods were. Pagan gods were just basically like human beings, but a little bit stronger, a little bit bigger. They were superhumans. And what Paul is saying is, God isn't like that at all. In fact, God is really not very much like human beings at all. Now, I say very much because, of course, we all know that God created man in his image. And so there has got to be something about God that is reflected in the being of man, but it's not necessarily what men believe it is. And so Paul is painting the picture of a great big God, who is all-powerful and all-knowing and, frankly, doesn't need people. That was a startling idea. Because in the minds of these people, as in the minds of many in our day, the whole idea of worshiping God is that people give to him something that he needs, or at least desperately desires, something that is unavailable to him, can only be given to him by men. And so if we give that to him, he's happy and he helps us in return. And that's basically the religion of many people, and it certainly was the religion of these in Athens. They had all these altars, they brought their offerings, they were serving the gods, they were, in a sense, paying them hush money, they were paying them off so that they would, in the very, very least, not harm them and maybe even help them. And Paul says, God's not like that, he doesn't need you. Listen to what he says. Let me read it, beginning at verse 24. God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath and all things. Now that's basically the way Paul began the body of his sermon. The introduction to his sermon was the compliment about the altar to the unknown God, but the body of his sermon began to talk to God about God in these terms of God's self-sufficiency, a great God, a big God, a transcendent God, a self-sufficient God who really doesn't need anything from men. Paul was trying to get across to them that men need God, but God doesn't need us. There's nothing we can give to him that he needs, but oh, we need so many things that he can give to us that we desperately need. Trying to get the right relationship between God and man. And now I realize that I've already gone 8 minutes into the broadcast without welcoming you to this Sunday, September 8 edition of the Beacon Broadcast, and thanking those radio listeners whose financial gifts enable us to teach God's Word on this station. Well, he goes on from there, and we come to verse 26 now, where Paul says, "And he made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings." And I commented on that verse a couple of weeks ago. And that's just simply to remind us that there is only one race, namely the human race. God made of one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and that the circumstances of our lives upon the earth, that is, what country we were born in, what color is our skin, what people group we belong to, what language we speak, and all of these things that tend to differentiate us upon the earth and to divide us as human beings, are all by the design of God. That's what he's saying. God has not only made of one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, but he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, which if you think about it for about 10 seconds, you will be enabled to understand what he's basically saying is, wherever you were born, that's where God wanted you to be born. Wherever you live now, that's where God wanted you to live now. I think I pointed out when I talked about this text 3 or 4 weeks ago, whenever it was, that some have misused this text to say, in essence, that God divided the human family and put certain kinds of people in this part of the world and certain other kinds of people in this part of the world, and that we should have stayed put, and the moving around was contrary to the will of God, and this moving around has brought about an integration of the different races and the mixture of the different races and peoples, and that's contrary to the will of God, and therefore we are justified in trying to keep the races separate. Well, in the first place, the first part of this verse tells us that there are not different races. Again, back to the first part. It's amazing to me how many times Christians will take one part of a verse and ignore the other part of the very same verse. We see it a lot when it comes to bigger sections of God's Word, how that Christians will gravitate to one statement and ignore others in other parts of the Bible. But it's even amazing to me how many times Christians will take one part of a verse out of the Bible and will emphasize that to the distortion of what it says by ignoring the other part of the very same verse. And this is one of those examples. Let me read it again, Acts 17:26. "And he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth." Does that sound like all men are related? Does that sound like all men are brothers? Does that sound like everybody has the same blood? You know, we talk in terms of mixed race and mixed blood as if there's a mixing of different kinds of blood. But the fact of the matter is, our blood is the same. I mean, really, from a scientific standpoint, our blood is the same, or we wouldn't be able to take blood from a person of one race and put it into the person of another race when we're talking about blood transfusions. Have you ever thought about that? That is done, that can be done, it couldn't be done if there were any difference in the blood. However, as in so many things, Paul is not talking so much specifically about blood. That's a metaphor for race. That's a metaphor for the differences in physical characteristics of human beings. And we tend to play these up and give them too much importance and exaggerate them. And the Bible encourages us to do just the opposite, to minimize them. Of course, there are differences. But what are these differences? We tend, for example, to put a lot of attention upon skin color. That seems to be a big one. But among those who are Caucasian, we don't seem to attach any particular significance to eye color, hair color, and perhaps other things that distinguish people within the what is known as the Caucasian race, the white, so-called white races of people. And the fact of the matter is, there are similar differences in every grouping among the so-called black people of the world. None of them, of course, are black. They're just shades of brown, darker brown. But among the dark people of the world, there are great differences. And among the Asian people of the world, there are great differences, so that a black people living, for example, in Africa can tell just almost instantly what tribe a black person belongs to, whereas to us, that is almost indistinguishable. I've been to Africa a number of times, and I'm among black people, and I don't see any significant differences. And if I do see some differences, and there are, of course, different shapes of the head, different body types, different facial characteristics and hair characteristics and so forth. And you notice these differences, and the longer that you are around these people, the more aware you are of them. When you're first there, quote, "everybody looks alike to me" syndrome, but they, after a while, you begin to realize that they don't all look alike. And that's just because you're in a new environment, a new element, and at first everybody looks alike because you're not seeing the same kinds of differences that you're accustomed to among the people that you came from. You're in a different setting and among a different people, and so at first they all look alike, but pretty soon they don't all look alike. It doesn't take long till you begin to distinguish different people. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to tell anybody apart. You wouldn't be able to tell Sam from Henry, and Temba from Crispin, and so forth and so on. So, yes, there are distinguishing features, but to us, they are just rather normal facial and other types of distinguishing features, but to them many times these are very clear tribal distinctions. It's amazing how many different tribes there are, and how in many parts of the world these tribal distinctions are very important and have been the source of great conflict. So that in Africa you have a lot of tribal conflict, a lot of tribal wars, and a lot of bad feeling among people who are all what we call black-skinned. But to many of them, there's just as much difference between different tribes as there are between black and white, or almost as much. And so it goes. And so then you begin to ask questions like, well, how many races are there? We've grown up with the idea that there are basically three. You've got the Negroid and the Caucasian and the Asian, but of course there are many more, and it's been a long time since I've been in school and read anything along these lines, but I remember a textbook that suggested that there were maybe five basic ones, you know, big broad ones, the three I just named, and then throw in, I forget what else, Polynesian and something else. But you get different textbooks that have different numbers, and what it really boils down to is there are as many as you want to make them, and there are as few as you want to make them, and there really aren't any clear lines. They're all fuzzy. If the three basic races never mingled and there were no intermarriage between them, of course they would stay more that way, and some people think that's the way it ought to be. But that's not the way it is. It's not the way it has never been. And so you've got all kinds of people who have a one parent from one group and another parent from another group. And then what are they? That of course. And what difference does it make? That's the real question. Why do we have to categorize them? And it's a tendency of everybody. Well, not everybody, but nearly everybody. The liberals think it's the conservatives who have all these racial ideas in America, but conservatives say, no, it's the liberals. They're equally so, maybe more so. And we see examples of this. I hate to get into it, but maybe it's been far enough behind us now that I can point out that in the very sad death of Trayvon Martin, you can call it what you want to, but I do not believe that it was murder. But I do believe that it was a killing. It was a very unfortunate thing, and I won't go into that now, but I don't think that there was any intent to murder him. But in the case of Trayvon Martin, as you know, the one who shot him, George Zimmerman, was pretty much consistently portrayed in the liberal media as a white man, when in fact that was not true. He considered himself to be Hispanic. Why won't we take his designation? Again, the liberals are very inconsistent here, because they insist that everybody is supposed to be treated according to the designation that they decide. If somebody decides, you know, in these mixed case situations, someone decides, well, I want to identify as black, then we must consider them black. And if they decide they want to identify themselves as white, then they must be considered as white. You know, that's up to them. And this becomes particularly important to them when it comes to sexual matters. If a person wants to consider himself a male, he must be treated as a male. If he thinks of himself as a female, he must be treated as a female. You can't treat him otherwise. Poor little boy who thinks who likes to think of himself as a girl must be given access to the girls' restrooms in the school. Oh, what folly! What absolute anarchy! What absolute destruction we are bringing to our nation because of this kind of foolhardiness. But when it suits other political purposes, suddenly this is all forgotten. So George Zimmerman, who considered himself to be Hispanic, was instead regularly called white, or I saw him called self-described Hispanic. as if that's what he claimed to be, but we don't accept that, a self-described Hispanic. Though I've never seen one of these newspapers say of the President of the United States that he is a self-described black man, even though, am I correct, his mother was white and his father was black, his mother was a white American and his father was a black Kenyan? Why don't we call him a self-described black man, as if there's some question about it? But, of course, we don't do that. That would be impolite. It would not be honoring him. If he wants to identify as black, that's his privilege. Well, the point I'm trying to make is, what difference does it make, really, when the Bible is clear that there is only one race? It's called the human race. And, of course, there's variety within it. God created great variety. But we are to recognize that he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth. God is emphasizing the unity of the human race, the sameness, the oneness. We all came from the same source. I think in talking about this some weeks ago, I pointed out that this, of course, does not fit in very well with the evolutionary idea that man evolved from generally ape-like creatures and therefore evolved, different men evolved in different parts of the world, and there wasn't any one particular source. But even that is changing. That's the way it used to be conceived, but even that is changing because science seems to indicate the other. The genetic evidence that seems to indicate that everybody in the world came from the same mother. I saw that not too many years ago. They even called her Eve. Well, that doesn't fit the evolutionary theory very well. You would expect that there would be different people evolving at the same time in different parts of the world, and maybe that explains the different races. But it doesn't. That was a theory based upon evolutionary theory, but science indicates something else. And so the Bible indicates the unity of the human race, and actually science indicates the unity of the human race. The genetic similarities of everybody in the world, every human being in the world, are incredibly alike. There's only just the smallest percentage. I can't even remember now what it is. But it's less than 1% difference in the genetic makeup of everybody and every human being in the world. And I think I mentioned to you on a broadcast at one time that I read in a magazine now probably a couple years ago that nobody on earth is more than a 32nd cousin of everybody else on earth. Closer, but no farther. That's the farthest you can get. Everybody on earth is no more than a 32nd cousin of everybody else on earth. That'll blow your mind. And I'm sure a lot of people won't even believe that. But that's what was reported, and I think there was pretty good science behind it. That, by the way, was in a Christian magazine, World Magazine, an excellent magazine. But we're all related. We're all related. That's what this tells us. And he, that is God, made from one blood every nation of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. Now, you've got two choices here when you come to the last part of the verse, and I've already set them before you, but let me do so again. You either have to understand that verse as saying that people are where they are because God willed it, or you've got to say God originally determined to try to keep everybody apart, but men overcame God's will. They thwarted his design. Well, let me read the verse again, and you decide what is the truth here. God has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings so that, going on to verse 27, they should seek the Lord, and in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from every one of us. Now, there's really quite a bit said here, but this may indeed be an obscure but faint allusion to the Tower of Babel, where God confounded the languages to separate the families on earth because, as we know, men were using their unified language to defy God. That's really what it boiled down to. And so God separated them for their own good, so that this unity of fallen humanity would not become a means to unify man in a false religion, but rather would break down the different groups so that there would be more likelihood that men would seek the Lord. And the truth of the matter is that God has been exceedingly gracious, even in the judgment of Baal, and it was Babel, and it was a judgment. The judgment because of the audacity of man trying to build a tower that would reach to heaven as if he's going to climb up to heaven. He's going to reach God on his own, not on God's terms, but on his terms. And that is the bane of mankind ever since, all down through the years. That's the difference between true religion and false religion. False religion is always trying to climb up to God on man's terms instead of accepting the fact that God is inaccessible to men except as God reveals himself to men. And the only way to know God is to humble yourself and receive the revelation that he has given and receive the mercy and the grace that he promises to those who come to him through the way that he has revealed. But instead, men are insistent upon coming to God their own way. Thank you, I can do it, I will do it. And God, in mercy, confounded the people and divided the languages so that there would not be this pride of unity and this concerted effort to overthrow the rule of God, so that men might seek after him. And it seems apparent that wherever God scattered people from the Tower of Babel was not a permanent scattering, not a permanent assignment. We really don't know what the assignments were, if you're talking about the scattering. In the first place, Babel wasn't a dividing of races, it was a dividing of languages. So maybe we should call every different language a different race. Well, you could just as easily. I mean, the word race is a very elusive term. You could just as easily. And we do talk about that. We do talk that way at times. We talk about the German race and the English race and so forth. Though we generally, we don't have any understanding. We don't have any common understanding of what race is. So we need to think in terms of Bible revelation, what the Bible has revealed to us about God and about man and about who man is and what God has done with man and how God has given to men many opportunities to seek and find him. And if man doesn't do it, then it must be man who is being willfully blind and stubborn. Until next week, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.